Welcome back, everyone, to the OIS Retina Podcast. Thank you for tuning in and listening in. This is Firas Rahal again, partner at Retina Vitreous Associates and a partner at Excite Ventures, which is out of New York. I'm here in Los Angeles. Today, I'm delighted to have my good friend and colleague, longtime friend, Dr. Bob Avery, to join us. Bob and I have known each other for over 20 years, and he and I have done similar things, but he's done a lot more of it. So I can't wait to hear about some of the his exploits. Just for introduction, and then I'll let Bob shoot in. Bob is a senior partner of California Retina Consultants. I believe he was one of the founders. He is a clinical researcher. He's an advisor to both InFocus Capital Partners and Visionary Ventures, relevant to our discussions here today, of course. And Bob is a member of many scientific advisory boards, some of which we're on together, and he always brings a lot of value to those meetings. Bob's background includes medical degree and residency at Johns Hopkins, the great Wilmer Institute. And I thought this was true, but I confirmed it having read up a little bit. Bob, you did your fellowship with the great Bob Mockamer at Duke. Welcome and thank you for joining the program, Bob.
My pleasure. I don't think I've done more of it than you. I think we're both similar career path lines, and it's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. I appreciate the time to chat with you. We see each other a lot at various professional meetings, and I always find it pleasant. You're always in a good mood. You're really an upbeat person, which makes people feel good around you, even in those sort of tight professional circumstances where at times it can get stressful.
Well, it's fun being in retina. It's been quite a dramatic ride for 30 years of retina, and it's fun to have better care now than we had 30 years ago. And any little bit we've been able to play in, it's been rewarding. So in general, it's a good thing.
For listeners of the OIS podcast, we invite you to register for the upcoming Ophthalmic Innovation Summit at CECO on March 1st in Atlanta. Join the leading ODs and industry executives to see carefully selected startup companies present therapies in development for glaucoma, dry eye, presbyopia, myopia, and retinal diseases. To register, visit www.ois.net and use promo code OISPODCAST to save $100. Don't miss out. Register to attend today.
I'm going to start with a little bit of the history on your career and your time in developing your practice and so forth. I'm assuming early on in your career, and you can allude back to your training as well, it was mostly clinical work. I know you're involved in a lot of research. Maybe you were in the early days too. Did you know then during training and in your early private practice that you wanted to get this involved in, say, clinical trials, research, and then ultimately into all these advisory roles? Is something you thought about then?
Well, I did think about it when I was first starting almost 30 years ago here in Santa Barbara. I didn't have as much of a choice to do basic science. I had done for the previous decade at Wilmer, I'd done mostly basic science type research and not able to participate in the clinical because I wasn't a clinician yet. And then when I'm a clinician, I'm not at the big mecca for basic science research. Although I never would have come to Santa Barbara if it hadn't been for a lab at UC Santa Barbara. Steve Fisher had a fantastic retinal, best animal model of retinal detachment, and some of the best morphologists to examine what was happening with state-of-the-art confocal microscopy and such. And I really came here to work with him as much as I came to build a practice. And so it's ironic that it worked out so well, but I had a little bit of both here. I could build a clinical practice in a nice place. It didn't really have that much competition at the time. And I was able to continue my basic science work, but I did know I wanted to do clinical research. And I guess there are a couple examples. I remember scrubbing with Mockamer on his first 360 rotation. He made a 360 retinotomy, and we didn't have perfluorocarbon because we weren't in a clinical trial at Duke at the time. And, you know, not many people have the cojones to make a 360 giant retinal tear intentionally and then try to twist it under silicon oil, which floats instead of holds the retina down. But that was his way of pioneering things. So I realized, you know, sometimes it's helpful to be in clinical trials to give the patient a better chance. And, you know, we've seen this throughout the years in retina. But I also got advice from Gene Dewan, who was a mentor there at Duke and at Wilmer too. And he said, you can't do the clinical research, Bob, until you get the patients, you know, when you're in private practice. And, you know, it was sort of solo there for a while, but we added, you know, we have 12 partners now doing just retina, and we have a big group, and it did become a lot easier as we got bigger to do stuff. It was always in my, you know, intention. When you go to Hopkins for 10 years, you sort of get imprinted that you're supposed to do research or you're a loser. So that's sort of part of the territory there.
It's definitely the ivory tower. And if you come out of there as you did, it's almost certain that you have the ability and probably the will to do it in private practice, even in the setting you just described, which was one of the points I wanted to make. You kind of led right into it. You ended up in Santa Barbara, which is, I'm in Southern California, one of the most beautiful places on earth. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to be. But was that the smallness a barrier early on to developing the clinical research program in terms of how many patients you could recruit and or develop?
It was a bit of a barrier because I think if you're a solo practitioner anywhere, it's sort of hard to do trials. This is before the advent of the DRCR net where you can as an individual. But back then, 30 years ago, most of the big trials, the ETDRS and all, were done in academic institutions. And there's been a paradigm shift. Most of the big phase three trials now are done in private practices like yours and mine, where we have a dozen or more employees, or rather surgeons or retina docs, and we're academically oriented. And so that transition occurred during my time. But I do credit one of your partners from the past, the great late Gary Thomas. I ran into him because in Santa Barbara, we happened to have the headquarters for a failed PDT company, Miravant, and he was doing a lot of consulting with them because he'd done some early research on it, and he was trying to help them promote this drug. And so I got interested in, or got access to trials. Of course, they put me on the Miravant trial, but Gary helped me get on a Vitrace trial. These are back in the 90s. And so I was able to get into these trials when we were only like two or three doctors in our practice. And so from there, we just kept going. And we probably have 30 or 40 trials at a time going now. So it's a lot different in the current world, but it was hard to break in back then. I guess Santa Barbara may have helped me in a strange way because the company was based here that I started doing trials with.
I'm glad you brought up Gary. I want to talk about a period of time that both of you were very active, sort of independent of one another, and maybe together you'll share with us. But something that a lot of people don't know about the history of our practice is what you said in the early days of the clinical trials for Retina Vitreous Associates, the group I'm part of. It was really Gary who started that train here too. Dave Boyer has taken it to very high levels, as everyone knows, is a widely known and famous clinical trialist. But I think in the early days, it was Gary who had been in academics and really wanted to promote that aspect of the practice, Miravant being one. He was involved in the early PDT trials of a multitude. So, and I'm glad you brought him up because you and he, and I credit the two of you, I'm sure there are a lot of people on the East Coast too, but out here with a lot of the early Avastin discoveries, or at least the early Avastin usage. You guys brought it along scientifically, you brought it along clinically, and I remember those days very well. What can you share with us? I think this is of great interest to the audience who don't know this history from 17, 18 years ago. You were in private practice, so was Gary, and I think the two of you were as important in bringing Avastin along to the rest of us in the retina community as anyone. What are your remembrances of that?
Well, thank you. I agree. I mean, we did have a role in it. It was a fun time. And my sort of history with VEGF goes way back. I mean, when I was a medical student, I worked in an angiogenesis lab for a year. And as a resident, I tried some animal models of other inhibitors and such and published a couple things. But as a resident, we came across this molecule VEGF that was just being talked about. This is in the 90s, early 90s. And Lloyd Aiello was a co-resident with me. And we started a project when, I guess I was chief resident by then, but of measuring VEGF in human, samples. And I got the consent form through the Hopkins IRB, and we started taking aqueous taps and vitreous samples at the time of surgery from a host of diseases, from, you know, vein occlusion, diabetes, even ROP. And the basis of that work ended up being the New England Journal paper in 94 that really showed the VEGF correlated with the level of diabetic retinopathy and was integral in a lot of different vascular diseases. And interestingly, most of those samples, even though all the authors but me were Hopkins, well, a couple from Boston because Lloyd was in Boston then, but most of the samples are actually from Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital, where I'd just come out and started doing a lot of diabetic vitrectomies that were, you know, here in the wild. But it was a really fun time to see changes. And I was able to, you know, use Steve Fisher's lab to show penetration of VEGF and not just, you know, animal models, but later Genentech had told us that the penetration of Avastin, rather, Genentech had told us at the time that, you know, don't try this at home. Full length antibody is not going to penetrate the retina, but I was able to do, you know, animal work showing, sure enough, it did penetrate the retina very nicely. And that was sort of understood because by then we were all using this drug. But that, to get to using the drug, fast forward to maybe 2003, I think they approved Avastin for colon cancer. Phil started doing Phil Rosenfeld started doing a systemic trial, the Santa trial, where he gave it systemically at the cancer doses and was able to inhibit neovascularization in eyes. And it was very exciting. I started offering it to patients, but there were systemic side effects. In fact, we had an ARVO meeting that we had a lot of investigators to see if we could set up a multi-center trial for the systemic use. And everyone was interested, but the consensus was it was too dangerous because of the small risk of heart attack and stroke. And so Phil was able to convince Carmen to let him try it intravitreally at Bascom, and that started the revolution. I saw, long before most people saw it sort of shown in ASRS in Montreal in 2005, I saw Carmen present in a small retina meeting or Wilmer Retina Vascular Center meeting up in Glacier Park or somewhere, Big Sky, somewhere in Montana. And, you know, he teased me the day before he showed it. He says, Bob, I got something. You're really going to like it. You know, we knew each other from ad boards only, but not, you know, we'd never worked together. But, and sure enough, he showed the first case. And this is summer. This is probably June, I guess. And I, you know, I went up to him afterwards and said, look, I got to try this at home. So I started doing it, you know, for a couple of months before that ASRS meeting. And I presented a series of it at Club Vet, and then everyone thought it was interesting. But, you know, Club Vet's low key, no press. But when it came out, when Phil and Moshfeghi showed it at ASRS, it was bombshell. Right after Genentech announced their Lucentis results, which should have been the best day of their life, it was followed by Avastin Works, which was like the worst part of that day for sure for them. But it was very interesting. I had already done 30 or 40 cases by then. And we progressed and started doing it. And the Academy that year, I was able to show that it penetrated, and Phil and I were both showing our results. And, you know, Gary did jump on early. I remember speaking, he asked me to speak down in LA at some meeting, and I shared our early experience. And so he really ran with it and got a lot of press about it from the LA Times and things. And he really sort of revolutionized the area too. And it was really a fun time to be offering something to people better than standard of care. We all were doing the Lucentis clinical trials, but they had been completed, but not, the drug wasn't available. And even before it was reported, we knew this stuff worked. We had, you know, we had eyes, OCTs were out back then and it was, you know, at Macugen time, you didn't have OCT or you would have realized it didn't really work that well, but we knew it worked better than PDT or Macugen. And so there was not as much of a dilemma trying to give this stuff off label because we could help people. And we saw what Lucentis would do. I had people in my waiting room, in the Lucentis trials or Anchor Marina trials, where you had someone getting sham and someone getting the drug, discussing their outcomes, like, you know, year into the trial, and they could sort of tell, well, I'm seeing better than I've ever seen before. Well, I can't read anymore. You know, they could break the code just talking to each other in the waiting room. I mean, it was a stunning advance in our standard of care. And I think the nice thing was that we were able to get it out to people in that year plus before Lucentis was approved. And we moved really quickly. We talked about it a lot. We published papers on it. I put the first series of AMD patients out there, and that allowed Medicare to give coverage. I mean, we had battles with the Medicare directors. They wouldn't necessarily cover it. They didn't say, but once we got, ophthalmology preprint of its efficacy and somewhat safety, they started covering it. And that was like a pivotal moment in its adoption across California and a lot of places before Lucentis was approved. Had we not moved so fast and people had started with Lucentis and there was this other agent that might work that's not on label, that is off label. And, you know, I don't know if the adoption would have been as great, but it was the best thing we had in the world right then.
I think you're probably right about the adoption. We'll never know, but is it a surprise to you now this many years later, how it exploded and persisted and continued to grow despite the onset of the licensed drugs, now many licensed drugs, or at least a few, and it continues to be a widely used, maybe the most used drug in the world for these retinal neovascular diseases?
Well, I knew it was big and had a lot of potential, and the cost being so inexpensive, if you could legally compound it so many fold, made it something to ship or to really change therapy in the third world as well as the second world. I mean, in our world, it was, the cost effectiveness of it sort of accentuates its benefit. The other branded agents are a little better and are certainly made to the specifications for intraocular injection and theoretically are safer and such. But the bang you get for the buck, shall we say, with Avastin is an anomaly in all of biologic medicine. I mean, all biologics cost a heck of a lot more than compounded Avastin does. And there's a reason for it, because it costs so much to make the drugs. But needless to say, it's still with us 20 years later. I would have thought it would have been replaced by now with better agents. And we do have, technically better agents. So the cost difference is, I think, what keeps it alive right now. But I do, looking back, it's been, as you say, like 17 years, 18 years. I would have thought by now we would have had a sustained delivery device that works, that, would have extended the injection sort of treatment burden that we have now significantly. Now these longer acting drugs and higher doses are going to approximate that. But I was a little disappointed in retrospect that, we were promised microspheres with Macugen, and, it's not easy to deliver biologics safely in a way that that can last a long time. So that was a little bit of a surprise. But I'm also a little surprised how broadly effective this is in so many different conditions. And with many factors involved in angiogenesis to attack, it seems to be such a dominant player in the treatment right now. But it's exciting that there are a lot of other things going a little earlier, not just treating the swelling, but treating the vessel growth itself and the earlier stages. And so there's a lot of stuff in the hopper, but it's stunning how powerful this has been for the last 15 to 20 years.
I'm glad you brought up the continued use of off-label Avastin and of the extended release or durability concept. I too would have thought by now we would have something along those lines. And you and I are both on ad boards for companies in those spheres. Outlook, who is looking to produce an ophthalmic bevacizumab, as you know, and as a lot of our listeners know, and Rivana, which is looking to develop posterior segment biologic drug delivery mechanisms. First of all, before we get into any specifics, and we won't go too detailed on that, how do you like doing that kind of work? You're on a lot of boards. This is more current now. We've talked about your history. You're doing a lot of time, spending time doing advising, and I sit with you on some of these. You always bring value. You're always upbeat, as I said before. You bring positive comments, but you're straight, and you kind of tell it like it is at the meetings, which is really what people need to do to bring these products along. How are you liking this part of your career now, and how much time are you spending on it, and that sort of thing?
Well, thanks. I appreciate the kind comments. I mean, I do like this portion of my career. It's been a shift towards pharmacotherapy for retinal diseases. And that shift, you know, from when everything was just surgical technique and such, and we didn't have drugs that did squat back when I was training in the dark ages, we've shifted to seeing better results in many different facets due to different drugs that we incorporate into our therapy. And I saw that coming, and that's why I was so interested in things like VEGF early on. But to do that, you have to really have someone develop that drug, that adjunct. It's not like it's a new surgical technique that you can come up with de novo. It's, you know, you have to partner with someone or wait for them to develop something for you to really go to that next stage of better therapy through drugs. I don't mean it the wrong way, but I do think that advance has been really fun to be a part of. But that is why I like to consult, because I like to try to help that along too and point out to companies what needs we have, what areas might be better addressed, where the major emphasis should be for their you know, decision-making process to what to invest in their own company. But also, you know, to, as you know, trying to help design clinical trials that can get through the regulatory pathway, which is not trivial and certainly takes a lot longer than I thought. I mean, it you know, from when Avastin, when we first started using what was a precursor of Avastin, non-humanized Avastin, to measure VEGF levels in 1993, the first stock I ever bought was Genentech. I said, this thing is going to be big. You know, that was in 1993. And unfortunately, the stock all got called. It got bought out by probably Roche or something. I mean, it's been done many times, but it was like, I couldn't believe it was a decade before they had a drug out. So, you know, they had the same thing humanized a decade later. I had no idea how the time frame for commercialization of things. But it's helpful to go to those meetings to help give my perceptions of what we need, but also learn from experts on what it takes to get through, you know, the regulatory hurdles. And so it's a learning experience. I give some insight, but I glean a lot of insight from all these meetings I go to. So I like that. Learning in this arena, I find intellectually stimulating, but also beneficial for our patient care. So that's why I do that. I can do what I want, but I like that. So I do that.
Do you think that, and this is for some of the listeners who might want to participate in that sort of activity in their career now or later, do you think the skill set that's part of being a good scientific advisor or advisor in general emanates from a history of doing clinical research, a history of being a busy retina doctor, or being a manager, a managing partner, as you have been in a big retina practice that brings a lot of business savvy as well? All of the above, are there any of those skills specifically that you think have been brought to bear as an advisor?
Well, I would say for most of the advisory roles for the pharma companies, I don't really use any experience with running a practice so much. Maybe rarely I do in certain things, but in general, it's more of the first two, the, you know, scientific and clinical experience where I think they're lacking, you know, or not lacking, but where they can use our insight, you know, and tell them, you know, what we need, how it would work, what problems are with their current projects or whatever. But, you know, the managerial role of building a, you know, a tiny single practice to, a, you know, 13 retina docs, that may be a more applicable for the sort of the VC side of, you know,
exactly. Market analysis, what's cost effective, what's not cost effective.
Yeah. And running a practice is, you know, running a business is, as an advisor in a SAB, you're just focused on the science and the clinical stuff. But when you're, say, on the VC side and you're trying to say, well, these people have this exciting research, should we invest in these guys? It's not just the science. It goes into things that you don't learn in medical school or in residency. It goes into things like, yeah, the caliber of the management team, and, you know, what is their, how capital intensive is their business, and how are they going to use some money until the next inflection point when they have a catalyst for making a bigger value or takeout or whatever. It's a whole host of sort of business questions. And I, I don't think those business questions seem to come up much at the SAB, you know, the scientific advisory board meetings that I go to for so many pharma companies. But they do come up when we're trying to decide whether to invest in this or that startup. So it's a different thing. Again, I'm learning and I find it interesting. I'm not an expert at any of this, but I'm dabbling and learning as I work my way through. It's fun. I find it interesting.
How about the back to the science for a minute? And I want to come back to the venture capital part of what you just said, because I think that's very important to discuss. But before we move to that, with regard to the science and the clinical aspects, what about the drug delivery platforms? We mentioned Rivana. We're both on the ad board for Rivana. How do you think that's going to, first of all, how soon do you think we're going to see something from any of these companies in the clinic? I know that's the crystal ball, but maybe more importantly, do you see this as additive to the market from a clinical standpoint or just from a business and market standpoint? How do you view drug delivery since we've been talking about it for a long time, but we're yet to have it in our hands? How do you see that coming about?
Well, it's one of those stories of shoulda, woulda, coulda. It seems like it should have been developed a lot sooner. I mean, it's just a tougher nut to crack than I realized. After these early 90s experiences with VEGF and realizing that an antibody to it might help, I realized we got to get it into the eye. And back then, injections seemed to be pretty onerous things. We would do, you know, retrobulbar lidocaine and then inject someone with endophthalmitis, and it was a much more of an ordeal. And so I had a couple of very broad patents for an external implantable drug delivery reservoir that would connect into the vitreous, and because I saw the need for it, sort of a reverse of the Bearvelt glaucoma implants we were putting into the pars plana for neovascular glaucoma. And you know, it was really broad, and it would have precluded the PDS, except they put their implant internal to the their reservoir internal. And I didn't think that was, I didn't, you know, when you're patenting something, you don't think of all the permutations. That's why people just step right over you. And, but anyway, so I've been involved in drug delivery. Those the patents are licensed by a company. And I saw, you know, the ups and downs, the waxing and waning of this. And, you know, we got licensed by Alcon and it looked great. And we did a phase one, and then Novartis took over Alcon and put us on hold. And, you know, and then we changed to another company. And, you know, it's just an interesting, but sometimes frustrating experience, how long it takes and how difficult it is to get something through the approval process. That all being said, I was happy to see the PDS approved. I was disappointed to see the septum come loose and it get recalled temporarily. And I don't think the uptake was quite as good as many had hoped, but we'll see if it ever comes back out again. I assume it will once they fix the manufacturing of it. But that was a good delivery system for certain things. And I could see it being a platform in the future once they fix things. But easier would be to inject a polymer or microspheres or something that could last 6 to 9 months and not have an external surgically implanted, erodible and potentially infection-causing device on the eye. And so I thought that microspheres would work, but they sort of migrate into the anterior chamber and cause trouble. And one of the problems is a lot of polymers that we've used in studies, they tend to denature the macromolecules, the biologics, and when you make them and put them in the pellet. Many of the pellets we use for small molecules just aren't, they're not as compatible with the big molecules because they're so finicky and you can denature them and they don't have efficacy. Rivana has gotten around that with a different way of forming the pellet using light and cross-linking it with light. And it seems, and we've seen in that company, you know, six month efficacy of Avastin in a rabbit model, which is really impressive because I haven't found many companies that do that with biologics. And so that's why I'm excited about that technology. But still, it's going to take years before we see something in the clinic if it all goes perfectly. It's just such a slow process. It's a very, very frustrating how long the slow wheels of development are with these things. There are other people having a whole lot of really good ideas with different ways of delivering it. And so it's just really slow for everyone. But I think that's what we need. I think most of us clinicians and many of the patients and their drivers are really tired of the every 4 to 6 week routine of coming in, waiting, getting injection, going home, you know, having an irritated eye for a day. You know, that sort of stuff gets old after a few years. And that, I think, would be great to improve with an injection of something that really lasts 6 months. And so that's on the horizon, but the horizon is a little further than I wish it was.
Ironically, I'm on call this week, so I did take a few of those irritated eye calls last night, right up till midnight or 1 a.m. So I feel your pain. You touched upon how long it takes, and switching hats now to our VC hats, and we're both involved in this end of the business now. It is a different world, a different place to be advising. You mentioned that. I want to elaborate on that a little bit more with you. You talked about how long it takes and to get these products to market. And what I was thinking when I mentioned the running a big practice part does sort of become more applicable here, as you said, and in more ways than one. I think also in the following way, for example, the device, the PDS or other devices, it does take sort of someone who knows the business model of a retina practice or an ophthalmology practice and how it flows, what works, what is profitable, what isn't profitable, what is temporally useful to guide investment and think about not just will the device be medically sound, will it be useful to clinicians in a meaningful way? Have you seen this kind of difference in how to advise the company versus how to advise an investment group in terms of understanding the mechanisms of the practice of this field of medicine?
I think we are seeing a little more questioning or you know, asking for our input on those components in the scientific advisory boards we go to. I think the companies are realizing that it's important to have the full picture. You know, you can make something, but will people use it? I mean, the PDS might be a good example. I mean, wonderful, you know, scientific engineering, great trials. And yet, even before the septum issue, the uptake really wasn't as great. And, you know, the reasons for that are many, but some of them are more of the practice management side. Like, you know, and of course, there's the risk of, you know, there's silly things like that should have been cut off, like the economics of doing it in an ASC where the ASC might lose money. I mean, those things should have been figured out. You know, if it were a surgical company instead of a pharma company developing it, they would have known that and cut that off. And they did cut it off, you know, close to the beginning. But there were issues that sort of worked against its early adoption. But you know, there's also flow issues and the reimbursement issues and the net cost recovery to the practice and all these sort of things that have to be factored in addition to just offering a good product. And, you know, the good product has to be really safe and not have a lot of side effects like conjurosion or whatever, because, you know, or explanting it because of that or whatever, because intravitreal injections have become our standard. And we do so many of them because they're pretty darn safe. I mean, we've somewhat perfected the way we do it. The patients are not tortured while they're in there. We used to think it'd be, you know, not many people would go for it, you know, back in the Macugen days. But I mean, it's pretty slick how we deliver so much drug to so many people in such a efficient and safe manner with not a lot of endophthalmitis, not a lot of, you know, corneal abrasions. Actually, we've gotten better at all these sort of things. And so the bar is higher for these delivery devices, especially an implanted one that takes a trip to the operating room and an 80-year-old and blah, blah, blah. So I think there was a little disappointment with the total uptake of that particular example. But these sort of components are good to look at when the company is deciding, you know, their projections. I mean, they need a big TAM, but they also need to figure out what uptake you're going to get compared to the competitors. And you also have to think in advance a little bit. I mean, if you were Ivana and several years ago, you said, we're going to make something that lasts 3 months. So people say, great, you know, and you fast forward a couple of years and like, okay, well, so many of our patients go 3 to 4 months with these single injections now. You know, you've got to be able to realize that it's not a static world in which you're investing. And you have to, if you have a very long ramp to get to the finish line to approval, you got to hope you're still desirable compared to the competitors at that future time point. That's another thing that's sort of hard to predict because everything is slow to develop, but it is a changing, you know, changing field. Every day it changes. So they have to take that into effect as well. But I think to get back to your initial question, I think there's a little more of that at the scientific advisory board than there used to be, where they may ask me questions of that sort. You know, will people use this, or how much will they use this? You know, and you know, in the VC side, you're also thinking, you know, how much is this going to be used? How much is this going to generate? So it's, they're aligned and becoming more aligned, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I've been seeing that as the startups are getting more savvy about their scientific advisory discussions, looking down the road at market share and competitive landscape more so than 10 or 15 years ago. You're an advisor to InFocus Capital Partners, my good friends, Ron Weiss and Rob Rothman. I've done a lot of work with them as well. You're an advisor to Visionary Ventures. Jeff Weinhoff is also a friend. You're valued to both of them. I know that, and I know you participate a lot. How have you enjoyed that? How did you get into that? I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. And also, any other differences you see in your role with that sort of advisory participation versus the scientific side, other than we've already discussed?
Well, I do find it intellectually, you know, stimulating. It's a natural progression, I think, for me to be interested in this other facet beyond just the drug being good or whatnot, as we've just discussed. I got into it. They both approached me. I wasn't out, you know, rooting around trying to join them. And so they both approached me, but I found it to be very interesting and was happy to oblige and join. And I've taken a leading role in the retina evaluation, I'd say, for at least to an extent there. And it's been fun because I get to see everything that's in the hopper, many of the things in the hopper by the smaller companies that, you know, are stimulating, interesting, you know, cutting edge. And so I like it from that standpoint. I'm also learning more about, you know, the deal making and all the stuff that I'm untrained in, learning by osmosis or hands-on, and it's fun. And it, you know, As I mentioned before, 15 years ago, I had a, you know, patents licensed to a startup and a drug delivery device. So I lived on the other side of it and was really frustrated. And so it's about time I learned about the full spectrum of this, you know. And so I find it interesting. I could see myself one day going further down that road, or even starting a company. And I've thought about that many times. And so in keeping with what I said about bringing pharmacotherapy to the retina, I think that is one of the major advances. I mean, surgically, we'll make some improvements, always do. But I think the bigger improvements are going to be with pharmacotherapy. And it's one thing to actually inject the patients, another thing to actually develop those injections. And so I find myself interested in that regard and being with these different companies, learning, you know, with them, from them, and imparting some of my insight to them is helpful all around.
You have a busy professional life. So I'll ask you before we conclude, a couple of personal professional questions, which is one, are you still seeing patients? And if so, how much of a role do you have there at this stage of your career?
I am still seeing patients. I will confess I've been distracted by some of these other interesting, you know, I hate to say they're more interesting, but intellectually more stimulating. I mean, I think many of us fatigue with being an injection robot after a decade or more, but that, you know, I still enjoy it, to be honest. I tweaked my injection procedure and the patients really felt it to be really great, less pain than many other people. So I have enjoyed doing that. I still like to see patients. But there are only so many hours in the day. And, you know, I also helped shepherd my group into forming Retina Consultants of America, a big PE company now with 200 plus retina doctors only. And so that was a couple of years back, and we're still sort of growing and forming and working on that and improving research, having so many sites. And, you know, so there's a lot of opportunity to distract me going to those board meetings and such. So I have more on my plate than I used to have, you know, a decade ago, just seeing patients. But these other things are worthwhile endeavors, I think, and worth my time. But I still don't want to give up patients. I like patient care. And, you know, I like to help the individual people. And I've made a lot of patient friends over the years, patients that really like me to take care of them. And so it's a little bit rewarding. And I guess I sort of like that from them. But it's something I'm not ready to give up completely.
Yeah, I agree completely. I feel the same way. I'm still full steam ahead with patients. And sometimes the day just, you just run out of hours with all the other hats. You've done so much. Final question, what's left to do? What do you have any thoughts for yourself? You're advising, you're involved in venture, you're involved in advisory boards, you're still seeing patients, you're helping to build a big private equity-backed retina group, RCA, as you just mentioned. What else is left? What other things would you consider? What do you want to do in the next 5 years, if anything else, or concentrate on some of these things that we've already talked about?
Well, I do have a lot on my plate, and I have still one more high schooler. My three older ones are out, but I still have one at home. And when he finishes, I may run out and spend more time doing all these things. But I'm trying to balance it all, and it's not easy always. But I find it all interesting, and so I'm trying to see what I like the most. And you know, I'm at the stage of my career, I could probably just do what I want to do instead of feel like I have to do this or have to do that. But I have a sort of defect in my brain that tells me to do everything, and so I still try to do all these things. And I think as I mature, one day I'll start saying no to these things. That's something I've not been good at. But I think if I have one goal for my life, it's to learn how to say no, and just hone in on the things that I find the most interesting and focus my energies. But I'm still in the shotgun mode, unfortunately, doing probably too little of too much, you know, dabbling in too many things. But I'll find something that really strikes my interest and probably hone in on that. But I'm not sure what that's going to be.
As doctors, we seem to always be what I want to do when I grow up, and even into our near retirement years. I guess it's ambitious on one hand, and perhaps naive and silly on the other hand. But this is how I think we're trained to be. Bob, thanks a million for coming to join the podcast. That was fascinating. It's been interesting to one catch up, as I've known you for so many years, but for others to share and hearing all these great things you've been doing for a long time and quite successfully, I might add. Thank you.
Well, thank you for us. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all your contributions in our field too. And I appreciate the opportunity to share some of my little tweaks there of the system. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.